And now on this episode of Miami Mic'd Up, we are sticking with basketball as the Heat have just tied the Boston Celtics in their first round series 1-1. Nobody better to bring in to talk some Heat basketball than Rohan Nadkarni. Rohan, it is awesome to have you here. I'm very grateful that you're taking the time to hang out, come back on the podcast. This is an exciting time to talk some Heat basketball. But before we get into any of it, I do want to ask you, what is something outside of basketball, outside of work, that has recently brought you joy?
Brought me joy? Well, first of all, I got to say, you kind of setting the record straight at your day job. I've been finding joy in that. I don't know how much you talk about that here.
I don't, but I'm down to do it. It feels like a time.
Right. But I also got to say, just as a Broward kid, how about the Florida Panthers?
Dude.
When you talk about playoff excellence. Just getting it done. I've always hated the Tampa Bay Lightning my entire life. It was really annoying with the Lightning, you know, who also sucked for a really long time, all of a sudden got good before the Panthers did. So shout out to the Florida Panthers, man. Like, obviously maybe not quite as popular as the Miami Heat, but every bit as successful the last couple of years.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because that will certainly be a topic of conversation on this podcast. Moving forward in the next few weeks, we just recently had Sasha Barkov on the show, and he was a lot of fun. And this should be a great run for them that, heck, for that matter, you know, we're talking about the Heat grasping at straws, trying to fight here against a one seed. The Panthers could be the team that makes the deeper run this postseason. So there will certainly be a lot of coverage here, so I'm glad you brought them up. But for the time being, we are going to talk about Miami Heat basketball because, boy, this is Thursday, which means yesterday on Wednesday night, the Miami Heat pulled off the upset in Boston. I believe I saw it was the largest upset in terms of a point spread in 5 or 6 years in the playoffs. They were 14.5 point underdog going into that game. They pull off a win, a 10-point win for that matter, led by Jimmy and Bam. It was unbelievably impressive, but I think maybe the most impressive part, and this is where we'll start, was the adjustments that the Heat made from game to game. And you give Eric Spoelstra time, he's going to find a way to make the proper adjustments from one game to another. He's now 10-3 in game twos after he's lost to game one. It's really a crazy record. So when we talk about those adjustments from Spo, what is it that impressed you most about the Heat's approach in game two that you think factored most into this victory?
Yeah, I think you kind of have to start and focus on the defensive side of the ball because, you know, obviously people point to the Heat's 3-point shooting and how impressive that was. And that was definitely an adjustment as well, but Spo obviously isn't on the court shooting those shots, right? Mm-hmm. And I think defensively, I'm even more impressed because of what Boston has done all year long offensively. And I thought the Heat very smartly took the Celtics out of their game. They took the Celtics away from what they want to do the most, which is shoot threes. The irony of this series is in game two, the Heat played like the Celtics. You know, Boston wants to shoot as many threes as possible. Their offense is almost built on the premise of, We know you don't want to guard our guys one-on-one. You don't want to guard Jason Tatum one-on-one. You don't want to guard Jaylen Brown one-on-one. You don't want to let Jason Tatum post up one-on-one against a smaller defender. You're going to send a double. We're going to drive to the hoop, and you're going to help, and we're going to shoot threes. And instead, Miami said, we're not going to send double teams. We're not going to send the help. And that's kind of been their MO throughout the years with Eric Spoelstra. I remember my old colleague, Michael Pina, wrote this story a couple years ago in 2022 when the Heat were in the conference finals against Boston. And in that story, PJ Tucker's quoted as, you know, I'm paraphrasing, he's kind of like, it's crazy, but Spo asked me to help off the strong side corner for a 3-point shooter, expecting me to rotate back out. The Heat play an aggressive style of help defense. They went away from that in game two. They said guys like Tyler Hero, Caleb Martin, you're going to have a size mismatch in the post. It might be against Kristaps Porzingis. It might be against Jason Tatum, but you're going to guard one-on-one. Mm-hmm. And that took the Celtics away from their 3-point shooting. So Boston, still played well offensively, definitely not to their heights. In half court, they'd slowed down quite a bit. But the Heat forced them to shoot 2-pointers that they don't really want to make. And I think that really slowed Boston down and took them out of their game.
That part was really the most impressive thing, right? Because everybody talked about it, that schematically, the thing that Miami would have to do is even out the numbers game. They were outshot from three it was like Boston took almost double the amount of threes, let alone made those amount of threes in game one, that Miami knew, all right, we've got to be able to run them off the three-point line, and we've got to be able to get some shots up of our own. The craziest thing, I think it was Tom Haberstroh who tweeted it out, that the Heat took 23 open threes in game two, which is a number that if you can continue to replicate would be fantastic. I doubt that Boston will leave you that open through the rest of the series, but it just shows that their offensive scheme was there as well to try to even things out while giving Boston, Tatum and Brown, opportunities to, hey, take advantage of your one-on-one matchups if you get that mismatch, but we're going to stick Bam on you individually for a large portion of this game. We're going to let him help in other situations where other guys are on you, and that's the guy that really made all of this work defensively. It's Bam Adebayo, and he was doing things that not only he does defensively all season long, but he was also sort of playing that Jimmy Butler role of the guy just kind of maneuvering around, trying to create turnovers, picking up different defensive assignments. How impressive is what Bam Adebayo has done? I mean, continues to sort of finally gets the respect of a Defensive Player of the Year finalist this year for the very first time. But what he does defensively, and even last night, offensively, everything he did, coming up with some huge shots at the end of the game, how impressive is what Bam Adebayo is doing right now?
Yeah, I'm just kind of beyond impressed with what Bam did last night. You know, I think outside of Nikola Jokic, there's maybe no player in the NBA asked to do more on both ends of the floor than Bam Adebayo. Whether it's anchoring a drop scheme, in this instance, anchoring a switch scheme. Last night, what he did offensively, I believe Cooper Moorhead reported he set the most screens he set in the game yet this year, freeing up guys like Tyler Hero, freeing up guys like Duncan Robinson. And then you mentioned the shots he hit at the end of that game. You know, Jeremy, I remember interviewing Jay Crowder once, obviously a former Heater when he was on the Phoenix Suns. And he said, what I love about the playoff series is at some point, you can talk about adjustments, but it comes down to a mano-a-mano moment. And you want to talk about mano-a-mano moments. Last night, Bam Adebayo hit three huge jump shots down the stretch. Now, you could be an analytics guy. You could say that's not a bad shot. You can say Bam shot this percentage on mid-range jumpers during the regular season. You know what? You might even be right. Maybe the Celtics wanted him to shoot those shots. But in the playoffs, you need your best players to hit bad shots. You need them to make plays. At the end of the day, no one remembers what your mid-range shooting percentage was in the regular season if you hit it when it matters. And that's exactly what Bam Adebayo did, going up against great defenders, hitting big-time shots in the fourth quarter. But beyond that, I mean, you mentioned there is no other starting center in the NBA who would be asked to guard Jason Tatum from the tip. And the irony is, it's not even that Jason Tatum was going against Bam one-on-one the entire game, but it's another wrinkle that forces the Celtics to say, if we want Jason Tatum to get a favorable matchup, now we got to bring him into screens, bring him into offense that he's not used to running, just to get him off this matchup. Take that extra 4 seconds off the shot clock.
Yep.
It was just a masterful performance by Bam on both ends of the floor. And after last night, since 2020, I believe he's tied with PJ Tucker for the most playoff wins in the NBA. And obviously Bam, unlike PJ, who I love, has started every single one of those games. He's one of the great playoff performers of this era, and someone who I think as time goes on will only be more appreciated for what he does.
I'm grateful for the way that you ended that as well, because that is the part with Bam that I think is so underappreciated, is he is one of those guys who, after anchoring a team for a full 82-game schedule for the last several seasons, he's missed a little time here and there with legitimate injuries. He had a shoulder injury a couple years ago where he missed time, and Omer Yurtseven had a 10 straight games of double-doubles, and you know, there were stretches like that. But this is a guy who's playing night in and night out through the regular season, and then somehow, both offensively and defensively, elevates his game come the postseason. And that's the thing that's most impressive. And like you mentioned, I mean, to see him last night not just be able to go one-on-one defensively and occasionally slow down and or stop Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, two dynamic wings, but then to be in the position of just simply disrupting their offense by doing it. And that was such a huge thing for Miami, was to be able to disrupt the flow that Boston has. And then you saw, they had some open looks late in that game, in the second half, in the third quarter, in the fourth quarter, where based off of the previous game, you would say those are the looks that they're going to hit. Those are open looks. Those are the types of threes that they're going to be making. But because their offense was so disjointed throughout the game, and now you're operating instead of with 16 seconds left on the shot clock, you're operating with 10 seconds left on the shot clock, and there's less time to make decisions. What Bam did there alone was so impressive. And you mentioned what he does offensively, you know, in the screens that he sets. You have Boston fans right now putting together compilations of screens, calling them like they're dirty screens. He's just a great screen setter, someone who's able to get his teammates open. Those don't count as assists, but those screen assists are so valuable to the Heat offense when Jimmy Butler's out there. But when Jimmy's not out there, it's a whole other level for the value of those. And that's why I thought, you know, his performance last night was as good as it gets in the postseason. But a guy we haven't mentioned all that much yet who really stirred the drink offensively was Tyler Hero. Maybe his best postseason performance, like one of the best games of his entire career. I know he had 37 against Boston in 2020 that was like just out of control. But for him to come together with a night like that, particularly after the game that he had in game one of 14-4-4. Now, last night, it's 24 efficient points, 6 threes, 14 assists, 5 rebounds, and just a couple of turnovers. Tyler Hero looked like someone who was in command of this Heat offense, and by Eric Spoelstra getting him some opportunities early off ball, he was really able to step into his comfort zone. What about his game last night do you think is capable of being brought from one game to the next? And what's your assessment of the type of impact he was able to make in this game as a star for the Heat?
Of course. I mean, what a bounce back performance from him. That's what the playoffs is all about, man. You're going to get tested. People are going to put you in uncomfortable positions. Yeah, you know, it's funny because people be like, Boston's a bad matchup. Guess what? In the playoffs, you're not going to get easy matchups.
Right.
You're not going to get teams that are great for you to play against. And Boston had the kitchen sink to throw at him. They had Drew Holiday, Derek White, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, all world perimeter defenders to throw at Tyler Hero. I think what impressed me the most was his decision-making. You mentioned those 14 assists. Yeah, maybe some of them were easy one-pass-away reads, but he did it. He made the right decision almost every time off the floor, and that's going to be key for him moving forward in the series. You know, we can get to, in a little bit, I'm sure we'll talk about Game 3 and what we think Boston may do to adjust. And we can talk about that, but his decision making is going to be incredibly important for the Heat moving forward because of the pressure on him as kind of the lead ball handler right now, with Terry Rozier's status still up in the air, obviously Jimmy Butler out. It's a lot to put on Tyler's plate, and he's going to have to continue to make those good decisions. I just thought that impressed me the most. He didn't get sped up, and it, just the little things like, you know, late in the third quarter, making sure this is such a small part of the game that will never show up in a box score, but just making sure that he came around screens fast enough to force the Celtics to switch Sam Hauser onto him for a number of plays. That forces the help, and that creates an open three. That's such a small detail that sometimes, you know, it frustrates me watching the playoffs when teams either switch soft or players don't come around screens fast enough. It's just those little details that can get lost throughout the course of a game, but him doing that, coming off those screens, are forcing the switch, all those little decisions you make within a possession, they add up. And especially when a team that, like the Heat, undermanned, down two starters, down their superstar player, you have to take advantage of every kind of micro decision and micro situation that you can. And I thought Tyler Hero did that. You know, it was that game against Philly where he missed a bunch of shots, and obviously it was very frustrating, I think, for Heat fans to watch. To a degree, you almost can't control it. You're going to make or miss. Sometimes, right. Some nights you're going to shoot over 50% from three. Other nights you're not. But the fact that he was able to make all the decisions, and I thought really uplift his teammates. You know, there was one play late. I think it was in the third quarter. The Celtics had made a little bit of a run. I think it was 75-70 or something like around that. Tyler has an open look on the left wing, but he sees Haywood Highsmith open at the top of the key. Fires it to Haywood. Haywood gets an easy catch and shoot look, drains it, stops the Celtics run. Not only does Tyler get an assist for that, gives Haywood confidence. Haywood ended up closing that game, playing really well. You know, those kinds of things, in it, you can't quantify it, but they're really important.
That's the part about Tyler's game that I think, because he missed so much time this year, the leap that he's made as a decision maker was sort of evident at the very beginning of this season. That first stretch that he had of 7 or 8 games to start the year really is as the lead dog for Miami, because Jimmy is not a quote unquote regular season player for a good portion in terms of aggressiveness for a lot of this year. And Tyler came out as the guy with the ball in his hands, making a lot of plays for Miami. And it was through the first six or seven games, it was like him, Jokic, and Doncic were the only guys with the stats that they had. And it was crazy. But the thing that really was most impressive was there were a couple games in there with eight or nine assists and one or two turnovers. And the thing that you were seeing as a difference with him wasn't just his body and being able to try to drive and finish through contact, but it was decision-making, being able to make the right read over and over and over again. And last night's game, game two, was a perfect example. You pointed out a couple of plays. There was a play late where he came around a screen and Porzingis was in drop coverage. And so Hero picked up his dribble, gave a little pump fake, which forced Porzingis to come into him, and he hit Bam with a pass who ultimately hit a little floater. And that was such a huge bucket down the stretch in that game. And it's just quick decision-making and precision like that. And that's where not only did Tyler Hero step up, but Bam Adebayo does all these little things for the Heat. And Eric Spoelstra made some really great decisions offensively to not have Tyler bringing up the ball every possession until, you know, late in that game where they needed him to go be the guy. It was a lot of, all right, let's set our offense and then get Tyler the ball already moving. So there's just one decision to make. Do I drive and go up for a shot? Do I take a shot coming around a screen, going for a three? Or do I make a pass here? And it just put him in position to succeed. You talk about those role players. Caleb essentially playing de facto point guard, bringing up the ball for a good portion of the game. Nico Jovic, Haywood Highsmith, who you brought up. Who's the role player that, if the Heat are going to make a series out of this, if the Heat are going to find a way to win it, if the Heat are going to find a way to force it to six or seven, who's the role player that stands out to you as like, all right, this guy has to play his best basketball to be an X factor moving forward?
The guy I'm keeping my eye on, Jeremy, is Haywood Highsmith. And I thought last game was sneaky huge for Haywood because he closed. He closed that game, and Jovic was playing a really good game. But I thought it was a smart decision to have Eric Spoelstra close with Haywood Highsmith because of what he can bring defensively. And I think he's someone who's going to be incredibly important on both ends of the floor. Because on one end, he is someone who has now shown over the course of a couple years, he can hold his own with Jason Tatum. No one's going to shut down Jason Tatum one-on-one, but he's going to make Jason Tatum work. He's going to force him into tough shots. If Jason Tatum tries that crossover, Haywood's got the timing down. He's going to get a couple steals. That's big. It's big because it gives Bam an opportunity to guard someone else, roam a little bit, play that free safety position. And B, if his three-point shot is going, that means the Celtics, they have one less option to cheat off of. And that means that they either are going to have to live with Haywood threes, or they're not going to be able to send as much help to Bam and Tyler Hero. So I think Haywood's going to be incredibly important. I thought it was incredibly telling. You know, coaches will say all the right things about their players during the playoffs, but when push comes to shove, when it is a big game, when you are down 1-0 and your back is against the wall, who is on the floor in the last 6 minutes of the fourth quarter is going to show who's trusted. And the fact that Haywood Highsmith was out there against the Boston Celtics is a huge deal. And we saw flashes of this going back to last year. Remember, Gabe Vincent missed a game. Haywood got some run, and you could see the potential of what he could be in this series. You saw him have a couple of nice moments in the NBA Finals, that game two in Denver. He's someone who I think is really important for this team and is a little bit of a bellwether. If his three-point shot is falling, that means you get to unlock what he can do defensively. It makes it much easier for the Heat to switch. I mean, if you have three guys between Caleb, Bam, and Haywood, you throw Jaime into the mix. Those are four guys who they can hold their own one-on-one defensively. So I think Haywood is someone to definitely keep your eye on.
God, it's the first time we've said Jaime Hawk is his name, and he's been so good through these first couple of games, both offensively and defensively. The stop he had late in last night's game against Jason Tatum, one-on-one, you talk about the mano-a-mano moments, that was one of them, and Jaime Hawk has stepped up and has really, I mean, gosh, he has shown no fear through these first few games against the Celtics. But look, the Celtics were the best team in basketball for a good portion of the season. Maybe were the best team in basketball for the entire season. Their offensive rating this year was astronomical. They have one of the best offenses we've ever seen in the sport. You expect that they're going to come out with some adjustments and be able to get into their flow in game three. So What do you expect the adjustments to be from both ends here, from the Celtics and from the Heat, in order to try, you know, if you're Miami, to keep home court advantage going into then a game four on Monday?
Yeah, I think for Boston, the first thing is going to be, what do they do defensively? Do they react to Miami's three-point shooting or not? Because, you know, multiple people have pointed out this stat now, my old colleague Chris Herring, Cooper Moorhead, that the Heat have four games shooting over 50% from three in their last nine against Boston, which is obviously absurd. And a big part of that is Boston daring guys like Caleb Martin to shoot, daring guys like Hayward Highsmith to shoot, daring Jaime Jaquez to shoot. Boston can play the percentages for another game if they want to. They can say, we don't think you're going to make this percentage of your threes again. We're going to let these guys shoot. And you could argue they might win based on that alone. You know, the Heat won by 10, shooting an astronomical number of their own from three. Another option Boston has is giving Miami a taste of their own medicine.
Yep.
You know, Boston has fantastic defenders in their own right. They're also capable of switching everything. You know, one thing I'd be concerned about if I'm Eric Spoelstra, let's say Boston comes out with Miami's scheme in game three, they're switching everything. They're playing up on the ball. Now Miami's forced to play one-on-one offensively. I think Spo's going to have to get really creative on that end of the floor. And he's going to have to be thinking in advance. He's going to have to be thinking a couple moves ahead. What's my reaction going to be if Boston starts switching everything? Because, you know, as great as Tyler was in game two, it's a lot different if, you know, Derek White is being switched onto you or Kristaps Porzingis is being switched onto you, as opposed to getting that drop coverage and making these reads. So I think that's going to be really interesting. Offensively, in terms of Boston, Boston's on offense, I think the Heat are going to have to play this strategy, and it's inherently high risk because you look at Kristaps Porzingis. I think he was 1-9 in game two. He had one of his worst games of the season. There are some post looks that he got in game two that he's going to be comfortable getting in game three. And is he going to, what if he makes four of those shots this time as opposed to missing them? The Heat are going to have to live with that. And I think what's going to be interesting is, what is Eric Spoelstra's risk tolerance? How many twos is he going to be willing to concede to Boston before he feels like he needs to send help? And now you're kind of getting into that three-point game again. So I think defensively, the Heat are where they are. I think they're going to have to switch and let the chips fall where they may. It's offensively where I think Spo's going to have to continue to innovate, continue to find new wrinkles, because Boston has levers to pull that can make Miami's life more difficult.
It's amazing that really thus far the Heat defense did that yesterday in game two without really using the zone. Their one stretch where they did use the zone defense, they kind of got torched. And that's been such a calling card for this team all season long. It's been the way that you get Kevin Love minutes. And now, you know, I'm intrigued to see through the rest of the series, how do you get Kevin Love in the game, who's someone, when your offense is sputtering, who can help get that going, not only with his ability to hit threes, but as an outlet passer, who gets Jaime going, who gets Nico going, who gets, you know, all of these guys really moving in that offense. So it'll be interesting to see what the counters are from both teams. And I understand if you're Joe Mazzulla, if you just say, hey, you know what, we're going to roll it out and do it the exact same way, because this is what we've been doing all year, and we've been able to win so many games this way. And how could we possibly expect Miami to shoot that way again? Except they've done it four times in the last calendar year, and it just doesn't make any sense. But we're going to go ahead and move away, actually, from this series. I know this is primarily a Heat podcast for everyone, but having you on here, Rohan, I do want to talk about the rest of the NBA, because you are an expert. Look, there's been a lot of good basketball thus far. There's also been a lot of home teams winning so far. We're only a couple games in. And look, we are recording this on Thursday afternoon. There's more action taking place on Thursday night that we won't be able to respond to. But what's the series that you're sort of most locked in on here, most excited to watch the way it plays out over a potential seven-game series here in the first round?
Yeah, I mean, like you mentioned, a lot of the action's been fascinating and fantastic. You know, we're not going to get to react to this game, but obviously Knicks Sixers has been thrilling and very interesting. You know, Clippers Mavs is really fascinating just because of kind of what's at stake for both those teams there, especially, you know, the Mavericks have really made a lot of moves the last couple of years to put the right roster around Luka Doncic. The Clippers are obviously kind of, they have this Paul George extension looming over them, James Harden, you know, are they going to bring back all these guys? It's 1-1. They've gone head-to-head in the playoffs a couple times before. There's really high expectations on both these teams. I think that's a fascinating series. And those games have been physical and competitive.
Like they played a 90s Eastern Conference game in game two. It
Yeah.
was like 8-6, 6 minutes into the first quarter. So I think that's a really interesting one. You know, Dallas has kind of found something in that series, playing Maxi Kleba at center. They've been really fantastic in those minutes. The Clippers are kind of the famous team now for going small in the postseason. Is that something they're going to do after Zubac had a great game one? So, you know, I think there's a lot of great series. I mean, obviously Lakers Nuggets. I think the Nuggets are going to win that one. But
Yeah.
if the Lakers can kind of break the curse that the Nuggets have put on them, it's going to be interesting to watch. But Clippers Mavs, I think, is genuinely a very fascinating series.
I think that's the one that we all knew kind of coming into the playoffs would be a fascinating series. And thus far, through a couple of games, it has been. And man, I mean, at different points of this season, I've thought both of those teams could win the NBA title. Earlier in the year, I was convinced the Clippers could do it. And then after watching the Mavericks against the Heat at home, seeing them in person, seeing Kyrie and Luka do what they do and those surrounding pieces, I was like, oh, this team can win an NBA championship. And yet, one of them is going to be eliminated after the first round. And that's what makes this playoff so special. The West is loaded and the East has been so weird. And speaking of that, the Pacers-Bucks series, because that's an intriguing one. Obviously, the winner of Celtics Heat doesn't face that team immediately in the second round. We're talking about a 1-8 matchup where the winner would probably get Cleveland. I highly doubt the Magic are going to win 4 out of 5 games against the Cleveland Cavaliers going forward, but crazier things have happened. But when you talk about the Pacers and the Bucks, this one intrigues me for a number of reasons. First of all, Tyrese Haliburton kind of throwing shade at Milwaukee, saying that the
Big time.
Pacers
I don't even know if it's shade. I think it's just straight up
calling him out.
shot fired. Yes.
Yeah, I mean calling out the Bucks fans, saying that the Pacers have had better regular season games this year and he's excited to go back home. Pascal Siakam, who's been spectacular as a scorer through these first couple of games. I saw a stat, it was on one of the ESPN articles earlier today, and I feel bad that I don't remember who specifically found this stat, but it was that Pascal Siakam was the first player not chosen as an all-star that season to ever score 35 points or more in the first two games of any playoff series ever in the history of the NBA. This has been a totally bizarre start. What are your thoughts on that series? Is that's tied 1-1? And there's, I believe, a game on Friday night.
Bizarre is a good way to put it. I mean, Dame Lillard's had two huge first halves and then kind of comes out slow in the
Right.
second half. You mentioned Siakam. The Bucks, their best answer for Siakam's unfortunately on the bench with the calf
Yep.
strain, and that's Giannis Antetokounmpo, who'd presumably be guarding Siakam if he were healthy. And then beyond that, you kind of have this carryover of the rivalry these teams had during the regular season. This is why I loved the Siakam trade for the Pacers when it happened, because you know we've talked about this a few times now. Come playoff time, as much as the Pacers want to be a run and gun, fast paced, up and down team, you're going to need someone who can get you those buckets, those tough scores in the half court. And Tyrese Haliburton, after dealing with some knee issues during this regular season, has not been quite the same player he was during the first 30 games or so. You know, I think he came back soon from that injury. You know, he wanted to be there for his team, but I think he's seeing the after effects of it a little bit. Hasn't been as great of a shooter or getting to the rim. But that's where Siakam has been massive, is he can just get you these tough buckets in the half court. And you know, it's not like the defenders the Bucks are throwing on him are slouches either. They have length, they have guys on the perimeter who seemingly can make his life difficult. But that's why I really like the Siakam trade for Indy, because I just think that he's someone who, when the going gets tough, he has playoff experience now, years of playoff experience of being able to get a tough bucket when his team needs it.
He is so good for them. And I believe right now, the average playoff points per game is 102 points per game. I mean, the Pacers scored 154 points in their last game of the regular season. So when you talk about it slowing down, I mean, it's literally 66% of the output would be the average score. And that's what ends up happening in the postseason and why you need players like Pascal Siakam who can go get you a bucket in the half court. You can't run and gun all the time. And that's the conversation we're having about Heat Celtics. It's the conversation we'd have about any of these series. So as we sit here today, you brought up the team that I imagine you're going to use in this answer, but we haven't talked about the Wolves. We haven't talked about the Oklahoma City Thunder. I wonder, as we sit here today, who is your favorite to win the NBA championship? We're just a couple games into the first round, but who's the team that you're looking at as this is still the team to beat?
Of course. And with respect to the Wolves and Thunder, who've had fantastic starts, especially Minnesota, I think it has to be the Nuggets. I think Jokic is clearly the best player in the league right now. And when there is 6 minutes left, 6 minutes left or less in the fourth quarter, and your team needs to score, I don't think there's a team that can do it as well as the Denver Nuggets. And it's not just because Jokic, who Anthony Davis played one of the best games of his career in game two.
Yep.
And down the stretch, one-on-one, Jokic was just giving him buckets. There is no one who can slow that man down one-on-one. And if you want to double, whatever defensive coverage you want to throw at him, he has an answer for it right now. And their lineup is built so perfectly that the team has an answer for it right now. So I just think when push comes to shove, there's nobody who can out-execute the Denver Nuggets in a close game. And that's why I think the Nuggets have to be considered the favorite at the moment.
They are so dominant. I saw a stat that since Aaron Gordon joined the Denver Nuggets and became a part of their starting lineup, if their starting lineup starts and finishes a game healthy, they're 38-0 in the Western Conference playoffs. The only team to go into Denver and win in the postseason since that happened, the Miami Heat in game two of the NBA Finals last year, and they lost that series in five. It wasn't a close series, and it was still, that's how good Denver has been. So before we wrap up, I had a few questions for you on NBA players. I tried to come up with some interesting ones that were personalized, but also, you know, some different stuff out there. You've done a lot of interviews. You talked to a lot of NBA players. I think it's important to note we're 30 minutes into this podcast. Rohan is wearing a Big Face Coffee hat. So for those of you not watching it, you now know that. But here's where we'll start. A player you've interviewed that was your favorite interview.
Gosh, you know, I've been fortunate to interview so many players, and it's incredibly hard to pick one. And I've had a lot of fun ones. Obviously, Jimmy Butler's up there, Chris Paul, Dwayne Wade. But I got to say, go with my guy, Philly Cheese, Dion Waiters.
Yes.
Big Dion Waiters fan. And he was incredibly vulnerable and open and honest with me. But beyond that, just a hilarious guy. So loved getting to hang out in Philadelphia with Dion Waiters. That one is very special to me for sure.
If people think I'm an outrageous Heat homer now, when I was in college on our TV show, like student-run TV show in college, we had, it was during the 30-11 run where Dion Waiters was going crazy, and I may or may not have called Dion Waiters the greatest player with the initials DW in Miami Heat.
There we go. That's the kind of...
That's the type of propaganda we need.
I want to hear. Yeah, hell yeah.
All right. So going from that, who's a player that you've interviewed or even just spoken to who you believe you could legitimately just be friends with?
Be friends with? Wow, that's an interesting one. I got to say, Brooke Lopez is up there.
Ooh, okay.
Brooke Lopez is a very interesting guy, very fun, very laid back. I don't know if he feels the same way about me, but at the end of our interview, I just was like asking him about his favorite DC Comics and what he thought about the DC Comics films. And, you know, he broke it down. He was ready to go. Loved it. Get into comic book history. And I'm like, all right, this is a guy that, you know, even if the conversation got away from basketball, I feel like we'd have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I'm hoping Thomas Bryant comes back next season because I recently interviewed him here. And found out about the fact that he really likes the Harry Potter movies and listens to Adele all the time. And I was like, oh, we could be friends for real. All right. This is just a silly one because come playoff time, we're always talking about, you know, mano a mano moments, you know, guys who are dogs. In your mind, who's the NBA player who's got the most dog in him?
I got to go with my guy, PJ Tucker. I love PJ Tucker. PJ Tucker will always have a spot on my all-time starting five. Someone who I think in his 1 year in Miami made an incredible impact. And you look at what he had to come back from in his career playing in Europe, a guy who fight and clawed and scratched his way to get back in the NBA. And from that moment has never had a glamorous job to do. And people say, oh, he just stands in the corner, blah, blah, blah. Invaluable part of a team. And I'll never forget talking to Max Strus. Again, that 2022 year when he was starting in the Eastern Conference Finals against the Celtics. And him and I asked him, like, you know, you've improved so much on defense. And he says, because I have PJ Tucker in my ear every day in practice. You can't put a price on guys like that. You can't put, to use steal an Eric Spoelstra phrase, you can't put an analytic to it. PJ Tucker is just someone who will fight every single possession, no matter the game.
One of my favorite Heat players who's been here for just a tiny little stint.
Yes, yes,
and also
absolutely.
One of my favorite guys to talk to. He was a fantastic interview and a really interesting guy as well, mm-hmm. in part because of all of that stuff he's been through and all the number of teams he's played for. To me, and this is prefaced by, I think the most improved award is always really interesting every year because mm-hmm. most of the time, that player already started improving significantly the year prior. So, that being said, who's the NBA player that you think is most likely to make a leap next year that maybe isn't anticipated by the general public?
Oh, wow. That's a really interesting question. I think this player, he's already very good, but I'm interested to see if his role expands. Peyton Watson on the Denver Nuggets is someone who I think has a ton of talent, and you hear about, you know, when he plays in pickup games with other NBA players, the amount of talent he shows and things like that. You know, he's kind of been in this role in Denver, a defense first guy. He's not really asked to do much on offense other than maybe, you know, take some catch and shoot threes. And I think people thought maybe he'd play a little bit more of a Bruce Brown role for the team. I think eventually if he gets an opportunity to play on ball a little bit more with that second unit, I don't know if it'll happen necessarily next year because this team is such a well-oiled machine. They don't need to mess with it. And he has a great attitude about what his role is and fitting in the way he needs to. But he's someone to have my eye on. If he ever gets an opportunity to do a little bit more with the ball, I think he could be a really, really good player for that.
I love that. I love that as a prediction because I also think you take someone that is that talented, who's known to have kind of more talent than their role allows them to show, mm-hmm. and you put them in a higher usage rate around the greatest player in the league, that's automatically going to allow you to have some more success. I think that's a really good one. And lastly, you know, I think we often talk about it as, hey, who's got the most to prove in the postseason? But instead of that, who's the player with the most to gain by making a deep run this postseason?
I think you have to look at one of the Heat's rivals, and that's Philly with Joel Embiid. And listen, there's no question about this guy's talent. And, you know, he was scoring more points than minutes during the regular season, probably on his way to winning his second straight MVP before injuries got in the way. And was that a frustrating finish for Philly in game two? Yes. But even with his knee issues, he put up a monster stat line, I think 34-10-6. He's yet to be to a conference finals, which is just kind of unbelievable when you think about the talent he has. So I think, and it's not even that people are questioning. I just think that he can shut a lot of people up.
Yeah.
If he makes the conference finals. And I think that would go just a long way in people getting off his back.
You answered the question perfectly because I think it's not that people necessarily are there, and look, there's always going to be people there to criticize,
right.
But it's not that people necessarily criticize Joel Embiid. It's just that he can take himself from a guy that we all look at as one of the most talented players we've ever seen to a special sort of legendary status by making one of those, you know, as a 7 seed down 2-0 in the first round to New York, make one of those types of runs where, hey, and look, we're having this conversation, they could be down 3-0 by the time people are hearing this, which would make it even more magical that have that type of run to go deep into a postseason that has sort of eluded him for so long. And, you know, was talking about it on Lebitard earlier today. It's not just this game against the Knicks that, you know, these bounces go their way. It's the Kawhi shot at the end of a series where Jimmy Butler was still there and they had an opportunity. Hey, maybe they could have even won a championship then in Philadelphia. So Joel Embiid is someone with a lot to gain. Rohan, this is a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I would love to have you back anytime through the rest of this postseason. Before I let you go, please direct people toward where they can follow you as we move forward into the rest of the NBA playoffs.
Listen, I appreciate it, Jeremy. Thank you so much for having me on. You know, we'll do this again, you know, after the Heat beat the Celtics in 5. Until then, if people want to see my musings, you can just feel free to follow me on Twitter at Rohan Nadkarni. That is where I'm doing a lot of my propaganda work. So
he's a good
people
tweeter.
Can find me there.
Yeah, you should go find him. He's a very good follow. And Rohan, I do appreciate you caping up for me on the, you know, hey, my quote unquote day job over at Levitard Show. You're setting people straight over there.
Having said all that, finding out you went to Cypress Bay, we do have some beef. But we could talk about that off air.
Yeah, we'll settle that at a later date. Rohan, thank you so much for joining me today on this episode of Miami Mic'd Up.